Welcome to Cider Chat. In this episode, we have a lecture on apples of New England, presented by an authority on the topic and an author in his own right on apples, and his name is Russell Stephen Powell.
Going up, going up.
Hello, my name is Rhea Wincoller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This is episode 244, and I think you're going to really enjoy it, whether you are a super geek already about apples, or if you're a newcomer to this space and trying to get a sense of apples, which is not unusual. You shouldn't feel like, oh, I should know more about apples. It's daunting if you have only purchased apples at a grocery store. There are certain kind of apples in a grocery store. They're kind of polished up, and they got the prettiest of the prettiest apples there, because as consumers, that's how we purchase. But at the same time, you might walk in there and say, okay, I want to make an apple pie, but what makes the best apple pie? Perhaps you ask your grocer. But in this particular conversation with Russell, he lends three tips on making apple pie, from how to manage the apples and also a bit on the crust. So stay tuned for that at the very end of his presentation, which we will be getting to very shortly. But first, I want to share with you a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. Last week's episode and the week before, episode 243 and 244, was part one and part two of Traveling the Cider Trail, which is taking place right now in my special spot of Ciderville, which is in the Berkshires and Western Massachusetts. So the Berkshires is part of Massachusetts, and we're just kind of dividing up our areas. And that means that there's orchard walks, there's cider tasting rooms that are open, and this is going all the way through into November. Because this year is a 26th annual Franklin County Cider Days, which would normally be taking place over the first weekend of November. But of course, like you, we are all in a worldwide pandemic, and it's just not a good idea to put yourself into large masses of people and bring them into your special spot of Ciderville at this point until we get a rein on this crazy virus called COVID-19. As such, we have set up a cider trail, and you can find all the details at those two episodes. Just Google Cider Chat, Cider Trail, and it should come right up. Or go to the website, ciderchat.com. This sure is a busy time for cider makers. It's a fall harvest. A lot of apples have already been brought in and pressed and are being transformed into cider. There's many apples still on the tree. That length of time can go into November, December, can even go later, where in some parts of the world, specifically Quebec, they allow the apples to linger on the tree until they freeze, and that is then made into ice cider. It's just an amazing time of the year. You feel the buzz, you feel the joy. I certainly do. And as much as I try to prepare for this time, to give myself more time to make cider, I'm always being pushed against the wall. I imagine you feel the same too. So welcome to this safe space where we could just kind of drop, drink cider, and celebrate. With that said, I have some big news about next week and Cider Chat moving forward. We're looking at that countdown to episode 250. We're five episodes away. So let me take a little pause here. I'll be right back. And I really want you to kind of footnote this announcement so that you won't be disappointed next week.
Walking through the orchards.
Next week's episode is going to be delayed a week. So there's not going to be an episode of Cider Chat on the first week of November. You have to wait until the following week. And so that means I'm kind of delaying the anticipation up to episode 250. And believe me, that's as painful for me as it might be for you if you're a regular listener who really counts on downloading an episode of Cider Chat each week, as you have done for the past 5 years. wow, right? You know, we've been through a lot together, Sidewell. So I know when I say, hey, I'm not going to be around this week, it's painful for me. It really is painful. But that's okay. I'll be making some announcements out on social media and keeping you attuned and abreast of what's going on. And perhaps if you are in my special spot of Ciderville during the first weekend of November, maybe I might see you out and about on the Cider Trail. And I also got some news that came in from the Northwest Cider Association that they asked that I share with you. And that is based in the U.S. So when I say Northwest, it's Northwestern United States. And they now offer a cider club, and they have 100 independent cider makers from the Bitterroot Valley in Montana to Oregon's Willamette Valley to the famed orchards of Wenatchee in Washington State. And they're going to be shipping this out quarterly. It's really easy to do. I'm looking at the website right now. It's making me thirsty. I'm salivating, so I better get right to it so I can take a break and get some cider. Anyways, the website is nwciderclub.com. And it looks like the box costs, you know, and you get a whole bunch of ciders in the box. They're like from $50 to $60 quarterly. So if that's doable for you, definitely support these amazing cider makers out in the Pacific Northwest, and that will help you start to develop some sense of terroir from that region, because there certainly is a profile that comes out in every spot in the world where apples are being fermented into cider, and that's really absolutely the fun of all this, is finding out new ciders, discovering, drinking at the site that they're made is really outstanding if you could do that. And then also figuring out, like, how does that cider pair with food? Like, what cheese goes really well with a Perry and which one doesn't? And that's kind of like a trial and tribulation thing. And in this upcoming lecture that you're going to be hearing from Russell, he has some advice on when you are discovering an apple for the first time, about how many to have in your little clutch there. You might think, okay, well, if I'm going to try an apple for the first time, should I just get one and then try one of each variety? He has some really good advice coming up on that, on how to approach that. And that's where we're going to go to next. The Amherst, Massachusetts Historical Society has something called Lunchtime Bites. And this is a presentation that they would do with different authorities on topics of history and topical issues surrounding us now. But because of COVID, it's all gone online, which allowed me to record Apples of New England, presented by Russell Stephen Powell. And this is a guy who I've had on my sites ever since I first started thinking about Cider Chat, because I knew he was involved in the New England Apple Association and also had authored a number of books on the topic. You're going to hear his full biographical background by George Naughton, who was the main person presenting this for the Amherst Historical Society. And I think, like me, you're going to be kind of like jaw-dropped, like, wow, I'd never heard about him before. He's really got a lot going on there. And his affection for apples, what he's able to do for producers around here and bringing the orchardists together is outstanding. So there's going to be links in the show notes to both Russell's books, which one is Apples of New England, and the other one is America's Apple. So those two books, along with the New England Apple Association, where there's a lot of info there right now, and Cider Chat is now collaborating, helping to cross-promote their work and really helping overall educate people about apples. So with that said, during this presentation, which was on video, Russell was holding up different apples. And what I've done is I'm going to be syncing his photos that I took, so you'll be hearing some clicks during this recording because I was clicking, taking screenshots. Also, there'll be some photos of the apples and some of the background of each one that is directly off the New England Apple Association website, which they have kindly given me permission to use. That is going to be going up on YouTube. And so for this week's episode, I am not going to put the full podcast episode up on YouTube, but I'll only be putting up the one presentation from this series. So if you want to stop now and go to YouTube, go to the Cider Chat YouTube channel, episode 245, and you could just watch the presentation and see the apples that he's discussing as we go along. Many of them will be familiar, but he keeps on adding on layers and layers to the history of the apples, and I really enjoyed it. There was also a question and answer period from the listeners of this video presentation, and you'll be hearing their questions. And again, one specifically on apple pie, making it, and some of his tips. It was a really delight to get to know Russell and to begin working with him. And I think, like me, you will really enjoy this too. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to George Naughton of the Amherst Historical Society as he presents a series titled Apples of New England by Russell Stephen Powell.
Welcome to the October 23rd, History Bites, noontime lecture sponsored by the Amherst History Society. And today we are fortunate to have Mr. Russell Powell to talk to us about apples. Mr. Russell Stephen Powell has written about and photographed New England's apple orchards for the past 25 years. He's the author of America's Apple and Apples of New England, and his popular apple blog, now in its 11th year, is published weekly from mid-August through November, apple harvest season. It can be found at newenglandapples.org. He currently serves as the executive director of the nonprofit New England Apple Association. He's a multimedia artist. His paintings have been exhibited widely in Western Massachusetts and on Cape Cod, including the Paradise City Arts Festival. His documentary, Shack Time, about the artist's shacks in the dunes of the Cape Cod National Seashore, was chosen for the 2001 New England Film and Video Festival and was aired regionally on PBS affiliate WGBH in Boston. And that sounds just fascinating. I've often wondered about those shacks in the dunes on Cape Cod. Mr. Powell's magazine, New England Watershed, a journal of art, culture, and ideas, was named Best Publication of 2006 by Utney Reader. He's authored six books, including Molly's 17 Rules for Living, Words to Live By from a Canine Bodhisattva, My Interview with James Baldwin, and Living Without Lawn, Rethinking the Front Yard. He's a New England native, and he's lived in Amherst for nearly 20 years before moving to Hatfield in 2001. So let's welcome Mr. Powell and take it away.
Thank you. I love to talk about apples, and what I'd like to do today is walk you through the history of apple growing here in New England. I have some varieties with me that I will hold up to the screen and say a little something about. And then I'm eager to hear your questions and comments. The field of apples is so broad that I could go in any direction, and I like to hear from the audience to see what people are most interested in. It was only a few years after the European settlers arrived in the early 1600s before we have our first record of apples in the New World. It's actually 1623, just 3 years after the Mayflower. We did not have apple trees here. We had crab apples, but not the eating apple that we think of today. But apples were very important to the early settlers for a number of reasons. Food value is obvious, but apples were also a source of sweetness. They could be stored year-round or dried. They could be baked, pressed into juice, from there made into vinegar or distilled into liquor. They could be fed to livestock. And in addition to all of those very practical uses, the four or five apple trees that people might have in their backyard was a familiar reminder of where they came from. They were arriving in this strange new world, new geography, new everything. And those apple trees were a symbol of continuity from their European roots. Very soon after, the Mayflower. As early as 1635, we had our first named variety, which was the Roxbury Russet. I'll be talking about that a little bit later. But for the first century or so, it was not important that you could eat an apple. If you found one that was flavorful, that was great. But the primary use for apples early on was for making cider, both fresh and hard. And everyone drank it, young and old alike. It was considered safer than water in some communities. So even the most sour or bitter apple is transformed when you press its juice and make it into cider. And even an apple that was known as a spitter because it was inedible was saved and valued for its use in cider. Some people don't know that you can't grow a Macintosh apple from a Macintosh seed. The apple is set up in such a way that a variety cannot fertilize itself. It needs a second variety in order to bear fruit. And as a result of that, the genetic material in the seeds and the apples from that have characteristics of both parents. It's like we humans. The offspring may resemble a parent, but it's not going to be an exact copy. For that reason, the way that we arrive at true varieties is by a centuries-old process called grafting, where you take a small limb off of the desired variety and you graft it onto what's called a rootstock, which in today's world is a small apple tree that's only about 18 inches tall. And it's chosen for some horticultural characteristic. It might be that it is disease resistant. It might be cold hardy. It might have to do with size, be a dwarf or a semi-dwarf tree. And that apple variety that you want is grafted onto that rootstock. And from that point on, that tree will produce that Macintosh or Cortland or McCown forever after. One of the things I love about this is it means that when you bite into an apple, some of these old apples that go back to the 1500s or 1600s, you are having a direct descendant of that original tree. And there's so many things from history that we can't hope to replicate, but you can know what a Gravenstein tasted like three centuries ago when you bite into one today. So until the mid-1800s, apples were primarily for cider, and cider was America's drink. At that time, because of the Industrial Revolution, we had people moving off the farms into cities. We had immigrants from places like Germany who were expert at making a cheaper alternative beer. And hard cider found itself under attack from temperance movements, both in the early 1800s and again in the 1870s. So as a result, we saw a decline in hard cider beginning in the mid 1850s. And it's only recently that we see cider, particularly hard cider, making a tremendous comeback. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But during the 1800s, we also shipped a lot of apples to primarily England and the West Indies. The apples were packed into barrels in places like Portland, Maine, or Boston, and shipped across the ocean to those destinations. They were apples that stored particularly well, the russeted apples. And again, I'll talk a little bit about them later. But that was the beginning of America having large orchards. Before that, it tended to be smaller orchards for the family or for a neighborhood. I do want to interject here something about one of our most famous citizens and most misunderstood, and that's John Chapman, who most people better know as Johnny Appleseed. He was born in Leominster, and most people know that, but fewer people know that he actually grew up in Western Massachusetts near the Connecticut River in Longmeadow. He was America's first great walker. He went all over the place in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana. That's where he planted his orchards, just in those two states, Ohio and Indiana. And one of the many myths that have come up around him, there are more than 30 states that claim to have orchards planted by Johnny Appleseed. And in fact, it's just those two. He accelerated the process of natural selection by going to an area where he anticipated that the European settlers were headed. And he would find a place typically near a river or where an Indian settlement had been. And he would clear about 3 acres by hand and plant seeds, apple seeds, because, again, at that time, it wasn't important if you could eat the apples or not. They were primarily for cider. And then he would occasionally come back and tend those 3 acres, and he would select the best ones, the ones that were the hardiest, that grew the best in this new geography. And when the European settlers did arrive, he had a built-in market for those trees. In some cases, land-grant companies required newcomers to have 4 or 5 apple trees on their property as a way to discourage speculators. So he had a built-in market, and he was many other things besides an apple lover. Unfortunately, he didn't leave any written record of why he was so passionate about apples. For that, we have to turn to a neighbor of his, Henry David Thoreau. They lived at the same time. They probably never met each other. They were born within about 20 miles of each other. But in his essay, Wild Apples, Thoreau gives voice to a lot of what we believe was true about John Chapman, that he preferred the seed-grown apple to the grafted one. And he was really this complicated figure, because he was a Massachusetts guy who was literate, and that made him a little unusual on the frontier. But at the same time, for the Easterners, he was this wild man. He was anti-materialist. He didn't wear a lot in the way of clothing. He liked to sleep outdoors. He was kind of a rough-hewn figure. So he didn't really fit into either world. But he loved nature, and he was a great herbalist. He was a pacifist who got along with the Indians. And yet we've caricatured him over and over again, particularly with Disney and some others. And I just want to say one last thing before I move on, and that's that there's no evidence that he ever wore a tin pot hat. And I think that's a way to kind of discredit him. And so I would urge you, if you're doing plays about John Chapman or talking about him, the tin pot hat is fiction. So by the end of the 1800s, with the downfall of hard cider and the rise of beer, the apple industry had to remake itself. And it happened most famously at the 1905 World's Fair in St. Louis, when a gentleman, J.T. Stinson, adapted an old Welsh proverb to say that an apple a day keeps the doctor away, which we still know today. And that kind of reoriented the apple industry into more of an interest in fresh eating apples. And at the time, the three leading apples in the Northeast were all New England apples. They were Northern Spy, Rhode Island Greening, and Baldwin. And I have examples of those three today, and I'll talk about them in a little more detail later on. But at that time, growers grew many varieties and gradually whittled it down as we moved into the century. The next big movement happened in the early 1930s. There was a brutal winter of 1933-34, and it killed more than 1 million Baldwin trees and many Northern Spies as well. And until then, Baldwin was the region's Macintosh. Baldwin was the New England apple, and it had stayed that way for more than a century. But after this freeze, with the rise of Macintosh, which had only been commercially available for a few decades, growers decided not to replant Baldwin trees, but to plant Macintosh instead, which were cold hardy and produced reliably. And from that point on, Macintosh has steadily become our most popular apple. At one point, it was about 2/3 of the New England crop. Now it's still more than half of the crop. the next big change really occurred in the 1970s with the advent of pick your own. Both my grandfathers grew apples in central Massachusetts in Brookfield. But when they were growing apples, there was no pick your own. There was no retail. My father drove his apples to Springfield, Mass. My grandfather drove his apples to Providence, Rhode Island. End of story. Growers could be just apple growers. They didn't have to be marketers. They didn't have to worry about dealing with the public. They could just focus on growing apples. That all began to change in the 1970s with pick your own. And to this day, it remains one of the reasons that New England is still a major player nationally. We only produce a little less than 2% of the national fresh apple crop these days. But because of our dense population and small orchards, we have a model here for, excuse me, for pick your own orchards that is the envy of other parts of the U.S. Growers can have people right there at the orchard, and they can see how the apples are grown. They can interact directly with the farmer in many cases, and it allows the farmer to adapt much more quickly. If a variety is not successful, they can change over to a new one. We've seen a change also toward more intensive planting, and that's particularly important in an area like New England, where many of our orchards are in the middle of a town or near the middle of town, and they really lack the opportunity to expand their acreage. With more intensive planting on dwarf trees, they have the opportunity to get greater production out of the acreage they have. It's a little bit of a different aesthetic for older people like myself. We no longer see the big canopies of trees that are 30 or 40 feet apart. Some orchards still have them and will continue to have them. But more and more, our orchards are looking more and more like vineyards, where the trees are 10 to 15 feet tall. They're on rows only 10 to 15 feet wide so that one does not shade the other. They're trellised or tied to stakes and heavily pruned so that more sunlight can reach the fruit. And it's a very different experience. It's very beautiful in its own way, but it's different from what we've seen over the last couple of centuries. So that's what we're looking at today. The New England apple industry is very strong in certain areas. Fresh and hard cider is one of those areas, and it's experiencing a significant increase in recent years. And retail, where we do have the opportunity for people, especially during a year like this with the pandemic, to get out to the orchard, to be in a safe place in nature, where they can see bluebirds and smell the apples on the trees and come home with a bag of fruit in the process. So from there, I'd like to talk about a few of these apples. I'm going to start with some of the oddballs, a couple of the oddballs. This one is, you see, it's very small, fits in my hand. It's called Lady. And it looks almost like a small Macintosh, and it has a tart, citrusy taste, but you see it's tiny. It goes back to the 1600s. It's one of our oldest apples, and its other name is Christmas apple because it's sometimes used in wreaths around the holidays. Some people pickle it. I've never had it that way, but that's another way that ladies are still enjoyed. You can find them at some of our orchards, but they're like a lot of our heirlooms, they're fairly hard to find. You have to look for them. This one is called Knobby Russet. And you can see it's a strange-looking apple. It's still on the small side. It has this russet on it, which is a naturally occurring feature that is harmless to eat. And the russet apples in general are considered some of our most flavorful apples, but they lack that bright red or green or yellow color. And as a result, you're not likely to see them in grocery stores. They're also on the small side, which is another reason you don't see them. And one of their main virtues is that they store extremely well. And with the advent of refrigeration around 1900, the need for these russet apples decreased. However, they have excellent flavor. They're excellent in cider, both fresh and hard. And this is, to me, the perfect example, because why would you keep an apple like this? Why does it even exist? This goes back to 1819. It has to have something going for it. It has to have good flavor, or we wouldn't know it today. This apple is called Calville Blanc d'Hiver. It's a French apple. It's also very old. It goes back to the 1500s. And you see it has these unusual ribs. It's a very odd shape. It's primarily a cooking apple and used in cider. And it was considered one of Thomas Jefferson's favorite apples. From there, we moved to New England. And we've had pretty good success developing varieties here. One of our oldest named apples is Rhode Island Greening, kind of the East Coast Granny Smith. But it's much older than Granny Smith. It goes to the 1600s. And it's an apple that's on the tart side. It's primarily good for baking. But a century ago, it was one of our three leading apples. And it's really a delicious apple, particularly if you like something with a little tartness. Moving to Connecticut, this apple is back to the 1700s. It's called Sheep's Nose. And you can see why when you turn it on its side. Some of these sheep nose have a very rich, deep color. And it has another name called Black Gilliflower. But we primarily know it as Sheep's Nose, and some of them are even more conical than this. It's actually, in my opinion, it's not a great tasting apple. It's a little on the dry side, but it's said to be excellent in applesauce in particular. One of our only apples from Maine is this beauty. It's called Black Oxford, and it's really the only major apple that's ever come out of Maine. It has a kind of greenish flesh. It's a little on the tart side, and it's also very good use in cider. This apple is one that many people will know about by name. It's Northern Spy. And the seeds for Northern Spy were grown in the state of Connecticut, in Salisbury, Connecticut. The farmer who grew them took them with him to New York State. And that's where the first Northern Spy was harvested. But we still like to think of it as a New England apple. It's an excellent baking apple. My 97-year-old mother to this day says this is her favorite pie apple. It's also a very delicious eating apple. And it has kind of a pink. It's not as red as some varieties. It has kind of a pinkish hue and tends to be a larger apple. From there, we moved to Massachusetts, and I mentioned earlier Roxbury Russet. Now, Roxbury is a suburb of Boston, but in our agrarian past, this lovely apple was discovered there. And it is among the leading revival heirlooms that we have today because it is so good in both fresh and hard cider. It's a delicious eating apple as well. This is an apple that is from Hubbardston. It's called the Hubbardston Nonsuch, and it was very popular in the 1800s. We can't really compare to England when it comes to apple names, where we have Pitmast and Pineapple and Ashmead's Kernel, but we do have a couple that were discovered in Massachusetts that are among my favorites, and Hubbardston Nonsuch is one of them. Another one that's very hard to find, but is still grown in a few places, is called Westfield Seek No Further, which was from Westfield, Mass. And like Hubbardston Nonsuch, was very popular in the 19th century. Part of the reason they're not grown today is because they're difficult to grow. They don't bear on a regular basis. And a commercial grower just can't afford to take a chance on an apple that may succumb to disease or bear every other year. And finally, we end up with Baldwin. This is, as I say, this was our apple for more than a century. It is beautiful for baking. It's beautiful as a fresh eating apple. Its main vulnerability is to severe cold. But among the heirlooms, if you're hunting for some of these rare apples, you should have a better chance finding a Baldwin than a lot of other varieties. I'm going to end with three new varieties, which are similar to each other, to give you a sense of where the apple industry is moving today. The first one is called Jonna Gold. And it was developed in New York State in 1968. And it is the product of a Jonathan apple, which is an heirloom from the Midwest, and Golden Delicious. So they put the two words together, Jonathan, Golden, Jonna Gold. And it was in an era when marketing was not very important for apple growers. And I think in today's world of jazz and envy and some of the other names we have, it suffers in part because it has a fairly bland name. But this is a terrific apple. It is has many of the features that have come to be associated with Honeycrisp, that light, crisp, juicy crunch when you bite into it. And I think has even more apple flavor. I personally prefer it to Honeycrisp. But this is Honeycrisp. This is the biggest apple to hit the apple industry in 50 years. It was discovered in Minnesota in 1961 and released commercially 30 years later, 1991. And people can't seem to grow enough of them these days. It is a wonderful apple when grown well. If it doesn't have enough color, it can be on the blander side. But if you haven't had a Honeycrisp yet, it's worth trying. It's an exceptional apple. And I was a holdout for a long time. I'm a Macintosh guy, and I resisted this upstart. But a good Honeycrisp is really a terrific apple. Because of that, everybody's trying to create the new Honeycrisp. And we haven't gotten there yet. There are a lot of new apples that you may find in the grocery store that I don't think we'll see in another generation. And many of these are patented apples, are not just patented, but trademarked, meaning that New England growers cannot grow them. So when you see an apple like Jazz or Lady Alice in the grocery store, they have some good qualities. But if you're looking for an apple that is grown by a New England grower, you should check to see if it's trademarked. When an apple is trademarked, it forms a club. The creators of the apple or developers create a club, and only certain orchards are allowed to grow those apples. And it's typically based on financial reasons. So our medium to small orchards rarely get an opportunity to grow some of these apples. An exception is this new one that was developed in Ohio, of all places. Ohio has not really been a major apple player, but this is called Evercrisp. And its parents are Honeycrisp and Fuji. So it has some of the characteristics of that we associate with Honeycrisp. It has that light crispness. But Fuji is a harder apple, and it's a later season apple. So growers are very excited about Evercrisp's ability to come in at the end of the harvest and keep well through the fall and winter. So those are just some of the examples. In New England, we grow more than 30 varieties on a commercial basis, and we have probably several hundred more that are grown like some of these in small quantities, and you have to hunt for them, and the hunt is well worth it. So that's kind of where we are today. As I say, I'm happy to answer questions on any subject relating to apples. And I'll turn it back to George to figure out how to get questions.
Well, I have a question right off the bat. Yeah. What was the impact of Prohibition on apple growing? I heard that they cut down a lot of the orchards because of the cider.
Well, that's the thing, that hard cider is, it has some alcohol in it, about as much as beer. It's lightly carbonated. And like any alcohol, it can be abused. And hard cider was the target of two temperance movements in the 1900s. By the time of Prohibition, it was not targeted on the same scale as beer or hard liquor. But yes, it was definitely an issue for the prohibitionists, and some orchards were affected. By that time, more and more orchards were being grown for fresh eating apples. So it didn't have the impact that the temperance movements in the 19th century had, but it did have an impact.
Elisa.
Yeah, thanks. Not this year because of the COVID, but most years I go out to the UMass Cold Spring Orchard and look. And so I'm not totally sure what they have this year, but most years they have like 15 different kinds of apples at various times, like Hudson and, you know, things like that. And that strikes me as a great public service for the apple folk.
We're seeing more and more of that. Even the traditional orchards that in the 60s and 70s had whittled down their varieties to maybe six or seven, the Cortlands and the Max, and the Cowns, or now the Honeycrisp, even those orchards are planting heirlooms because they recognize that while the volume may be small, people are really interested in getting that full range of flavors and textures and colors from apples. And the thing with heirlooms, they may have 9 out of 10 properties that are excellent, but that one last property may keep them from being grown on a commercial scale. They may be biennial bearers. Maybe the core is too big. Maybe they're misshapen. It's one thing that may keep them out of our supermarkets. But many of these are not only excellent apples, but really give us a sense of just the range of this amazing fruit that has anything from pineapple flavors in some cases to banana to orange to nuts. And to get all of that, you've got to try some of these non-traditional apples.
Well, we're lucky we're not dependent on grocery stores for our apples.
Yes. Although you should be able to find New England apples pretty much throughout the year in the grocery stores. Our storage methods have improved so much that I've had some of the best Macintosh I've had as late as April. And a Stamen, that's an old, it's a wonderful heirloom apple. And it's one of the best apples I had last year was a Stamen, and it was in the month of April. So we've gotten a lot better, and we can expect a lot more from our supermarkets. And I think it's helpful when consumers appreciate the difference between a locally grown apple and some of these varieties that are trademarked that we are not even eligible to grow here.
Carol Johnson.
Yeah, I didn't hear you speak about Cortland apples, which are among the favorites of my in-laws and family.
Cortland, to me, it's one of my all-time favorites. The Macintosh apple, in addition to being our most popular, has been a parent to some of our other popular apples, and Cortland is one of them. So is McCown. So is Empire. But Cortland, its other parent is Ben Davis. And Ben Davis still exists as an heirloom in small quantities. It's not a highly regarded apple for its flavor. But when you combine that with the Macintosh to get a Cortland, it is just one of the best apples because it's reliable as a tree to grow. It has good size. It's excellent as a fresh eating apple, and it's known for its flesh being slow to turn color. So it's really appreciated for salads. It tends to be used in Waldorf salads, and yet it's a great baker. People will sometimes ask me if they're planting trees in their backyard, what varieties they should use. And I almost always include Cortland in the answer because it's so versatile and so reliable.
Thank you.
Nancy Eddy.
Thank you. My former next door neighbor.
Yes, hi, Nancy.
Nice to see you.
Same here.
And I'm sorry, I came in a little late. So if you've already talked about this apple, forgive me. My father's favorite apple was a Jonathan. And we found a Jonathan tree to plant for him for about, I don't know, probably his 70th birthday at his home. And I can never find Jonathans in the stores or in the local farmer market at all.
They are today primarily a Midwestern apple. And their fans are devoted. And I have come across people in New England who are searching for Jonathans. I know a few orchards that grow them. Clark Brothers up in Ashfield grows them.
Oh, okay.
But there are several others. Stone Mountain Farm in Belmont, New Hampshire. I was there recently and they have them. One thing you can do, it's not perfect, but if you go to the New England Apple Association website, which is newenglandapples.org, you can search for the variety and it will tell you who grows it. Now, not every grower has kept up their listing. So it's, as I say, it's not perfect. And if you have a favorite orchard to go to, you can certainly call ahead and see if they have Jonathan's. But they are out there and they do have their fans.
Yep.
And they're also the parent of Jonagold, the apple I was referring to earlier, which I figured
they must be. Yeah.
Apple.
I had another question, which are, what are some of the oldest breeds of apples? You talked about some old breeds going back hundreds of years. And what are some of the oldest ones that are still around?
Yeah. One of my favorites is an early season apple that probably is too late in the year, but you might find some is Gravenstein. And that typically comes out in late August. Some people love it as a pie apple, but it's a really delicious, fresh-eating apple. I know Atkins has had them in the past. And that goes back to the 1500s. Lady, the apple I showed earlier, this goes back to the 1600s. So this is one of our very old apples. And Calville Blanc is from the 1500s. So we do have a number of them that go back to the 1700s and a few to the 1600s. The apple itself goes back thousands of years, originating in forests in Kazakhstan. And some of those forests still have a range of genetic material for apples. Some of the trees look like oak trees, and some have very misshapen and weird-looking fruit. That's where the apple began.
Do people go back there and try to get more genetic material for apples?
They do, but it's limited access. You have to have permission to be able to go there.
I suppose.
Regarded. I would love to go there, but I don't know.
Russell, do you bake pies yourself?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Then my question is this. I know I usually go to Atkins, have a whole list of which apples are suitable for what. Mm-hmm. Now, to make an apple pie, you select among the baking apples. Now, is a mixture of several apples better for a pie, or should you just stick to one variety?
You know, there's no right answer to that. we've been judges at a pie contest at Mount Wachusett for the last 9 years. We've done an event in Connecticut where pies were made by a baker using just single varieties. And, you know, it's hard to choose. The basic rule when it comes to making a pie is that almost any apple that you love will work. I tend to mix varieties in part because I love Macintosh for its flavor and its aroma. It is a softer apple and tends to cook down. So I will tend to mix Macintosh with maybe a couple of Cortlands or something mm-hmm. else to improve the texture. But there really is no wrong answer to that. The things that we emphasize when it comes to cooking with apples, one is to leave the skins on because much of the apple's nutrition is concentrated near beneath the skin. It also adds some color and texture to whatever you're cooking. And not to mention the fact that it takes a little less time if you don't have to peel all the apples. And for a lot of recipes we come through, this is changing very slowly, but for many of the recipes that we find in cookbooks from the 50s and 60s and even 70s, they have far too much sugar. The apple is naturally sweet. And when I bite into a pie or a turnover or any baked apple good, I want to taste apple. I don't want to just taste sugar. So we will often cut the sugar back by as much as a half. And we never feel like we're not getting enough sweetness out of it. And you get more apple flavor. We also will sometimes substitute applesauce for some of the fat or all of the fat. That's another way to make it a little healthier. And this doesn't relate specifically to apples, but we also tend to use a mix of white and whole wheat flour. The exception being pies, because whole wheat flour is very difficult to work with if you use it for rolling out pastry.
Yeah.
For a lot of the dishes we make, we do about a 50-50 blend between regular and whole wheat flour.
Thank you.
So how did you become interested in apples at first?
Well, it's a good question. As I said, both my grandfathers grew apples in Central Mass, and the farm that I grew up on was no longer producing apples when I grew up. We had a couple of blocks of trees on the property, but I still remember the other farm, Elm Hill Farm in Brookfield, which coincidentally was home of the original Elsie the cow. They also had Morgan horses, and they had apples. And I remember going to the apple barn and that smell of apples filling up the whole room. And yet then I went on to a career. I began as a print journalist and I worked in public relations. I came to the area to work at Hampshire College for many years. I worked at Greenfield Community College. And then just coincidentally partnered with a woman who was working with the Apple Association in the 90s. And we worked together for a couple of years. She had two young boys and dropped out, and I was left as the guy, and I've been doing it ever since.
A couple of reminiscences. When I was a kid, our family made applesauce from Gravenstein's, 4 bushels every August. So, I was part of the group sitting on the porch peeling and taking out cores, and our mother was the one in the kitchen with the steam and the whatever. The other apple that we really liked from Pennsylvania was winesap, which is absolutely delicious, but really isn't grown in New England. I think it's not frost hardy or sufficiently.
You can find it here. It's had an interesting history because it was discovered in New Jersey, but we think of it really as a southern apple. It does need a longer growing season. Having said that, I have seen some winesaps this fall. It's a smaller apple, has a beautiful red, almost cherry red color, and great flavor.
Well.
Great flavor,
well.
Yeah. So if you are lucky enough to find a winesap, by all means, you should try them. And when you're trying a new variety, we suggest that you buy 3 or 4, and you eat one right away, and you put the others in your refrigerator, and you try another one in about 30 days, and you notice the difference, because some varieties improve in storage. And what you may find is an okay apple when it's picked, a month or two later is outstanding. Sun Crisp, Ida Red, Ribston Pippin, those are all examples of apples that are good when they're fresh picked, but really excel when they've had a couple of months in storage.
Thank you for your time. I look forward to tasting some of these varieties you've talked about. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome. Before we sign off, I do publish my Apple weblog weekly from mid-August through November. And if anybody would like to receive it through email, if you send me your email address to Russ, R-U-S-S, at newenglandapples.org, I will be happy to put you on that list. It comes out before the weekend, so that if you're making plans on what to do, this will have some suggestions. We talk about the different varieties and have orchard photography and recipes. I'll be posting one later today that's got a wonderful recipe for apple lemon cake. So if anybody's interested, just send me your email.
Thank you to the Amherst Historical Society and Russell Stephen Powell for this week's episode 245, Apples of New England.
Smelling all the blossoms.
Thank you to the following commercial businesses who are supporters of this here podcast on the Cider Going Up campaign. That would be Process NMR Associates LLC. John Edwards is the man behind this company that does analysis of cider. Contact John Edwards at Process NMR Associates LLC. There is a link at the Cider Going Up campaign page at ciderchat.com. And also, when you're next in Ross-on-Wye in the UK, that's out in West Country, do check out Ross-on-Wye Cider and Perry Company. Of course, they ship out pretty wildly, but there's nothing better than going to Ross-on-Wye. And the Spacetime Mead and Ciderworks, based in Dunmore, Pennsylvania. Now, you might be thinking, where the heck is that? Well, that's just outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is really just a short drive out of New York City. I've gone through that area many a days on my travels through Pennsylvania in a couple of years past. And I'm just kind of regretful now that I'm not working there, so I can't make a regular stop at Spacetime Mead and Ciderworks. But I'm hoping you can and keep an eye out for their bottles out in the stores. And then there is also Insider Japan. The person behind Insider Japan is none other than Lee Reeve. And if you have been in the cider news for any number of days and you haven't seen something by Insider Japan, I'd be really surprised, because Lee is so passionate about it and what he's doing for cider in Japan, and also kind of raising awareness throughout the world, is really outstanding. So a big tip of the glass to Insider Japan, which is a bilingual, is both English and Japanese quarterly magazine, all on cider. You know, I'm so thankful for all the commercial cideries and folks who are part of commercial cideries who are donating regularly to Cider Chat, keeping this podcast on the air as we move into the sixth season, which you could read as the sixth year of Cider Chat. So big tip of the glass to all you folks. And if you'd like to help support this podcast too, you could do that at ciderchat.com. There's a donate button, or become a patron at the Cider Chat page at Patreon. That's spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And with that, I leave you here. This is Real Wind Caller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. Ponds. We love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet,
oh yeah.
We like cider,
ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms,
oh yes we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!